tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Look at the way the world has changed in just a few short months. Since the Yom Kippur War, little countries you probably virtually never heard of before and can scarcely pronounce their names have become some of the most wealthy and growing wealthier every day on the face of the earth. Tiny little Arab countries and sheikdoms in the Gulf there are now sitting atop mountainous piles of soaring billions upon billions of American dollars, of Deutschmarks, of Dutch guilders, of Belgian and French francs, of Italian lira. And there is grave concern throughout all of Europe because of jobless millions and unemployment. Unemployment soaring in the United States to be about as bad as it was clear back in 1940 and 41, just barely before World War II. Isn't it an incredible shift in world climate and in trends in this world to find that in only a few short months, a lot of what a lot of people would have said were just Mickey Mouse little countries of deserts and a few oil wells and practically no paved roads and old, decrepit, mud-walled cities are now seemingly giants in the world's economy, and like an Arab scimitar held menacingly right over the jugular of Israel and even of the free Western powers and Japan, all of the industrialized, affluent countries of the world are tottering, practically being brought to their knees by something that is not too terribly short of blackmail. They're being given warnings about their political stances toward Israel and the Arabs. The approach of Europe toward the Middle East, that of Japan toward the Middle East, and that of the United States toward the Middle East, all of these have dramatically changed as a direct result of what has occurred since the Yom Kippur War. Prior to being forced out of office because of the Watergate scandal, Mr. Nixon went to Egypt, remember? Maybe in the helter-skelter, unbelievable, kaleidoscopic series of events that have taken your attention and your concern since that time, you had forgotten about that trip when Mr. Nixon went down there and began promising some of our Arab friends nuclear reactors from the United States, and maybe you've forgotten that the Soviet Union is also promising them nuclear reactors. And of course now we have the spectacle of both Israel and Egypt talking nuclear weapons. Well, the United States shifted dramatically in its approach toward some of the Arab countries. And when Congress recently voted even more than originally had been asked for in the foreign aid budget of our federal government, it was clearly indicated that many of those funds were earmarked for such nations as Iraq, Syria, Egypt, Jordan. That includes food, that includes nuclear reactors, it includes, if necessary, even military aid. So, you know, it's so incredible to look at a world such as this, where much of the developed world is practically on its knees with grave, deep economic sickness as a direct result of the skyrocketing price of the world's most essential raw material today because of our machine age, oil, and wondering where we go from here. Well, right now, spreading all over Europe, is an economic blight that could bring the end of the post-war boom to Europe and has caused grave concern there for officials, for instance, Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, who has flown to Washington recently and has addressed the American people over the media, his speech that he gave on arrival, plus some of the occasions of state that he attended with President Ford, have been very much in the news. But Mr. Schmidt is here, it is no secret, to confront the American government on the clear fact of the serious downswing in the German economy and their own critical unemployment rate, which is soaring up at an unprecedented rate. For example, production in West Germany may rise by only 1.5% against a gain of 5.3% back in 1973. Volkswagen, for example, has more than 40,000 of its workers on a three-week-a-month work schedule, with the other week off, and of course they're only being paid for those 3 weeks. Daimler-Benz, you all have heard of that, of course, the Mercedes-Benz and so on that comes from that company, has put 3,100 of its 8,100 workers at the Düsseldorf and Bremen plants on short time because of a slump in truck orders. And Siemens AG, the electronics company, multi-billion dollar concern, has laid off 6,000 of its employees. AT&T, in the West German subsidiary, is only putting in about half as many telephones as they used to. The Ford sales in Germany have fallen by one-third. That's dramatic. You know, for a while, I was able to report on this program continually that while all the other countries of Western Europe seem to be getting deeper in debt with balance of payments deficits, that Germany always seemed to have a surplus. And the reason for that, of course, was because they exported more than they imported, and that's what created the surplus. Now, exports are slowing. Unemployment had reached by October of 1974, 672,000 people. And that was the highest since October of 1955. Still, in spite of that, and that's serious, and the German Chancellor is here to talk to President Ford about it, that's only a 7% inflation rate in West Germany. And now, don't think that that's contradictory, because inflation and recession can come at the same time, and yet they're totally different effects. A recession in business, a slowdown in sales, and inflation are two total opposites. Inflation merely means higher prices. It means runaway prices, no controls. It means complete instability in what things cost, that things are costing more and more and more. Where depression or recession means a slowdown in building, a slowdown in sales, a slowdown in business and industry. So while we're producing fewer goods, we're charging higher and higher prices for them. Now, the point that Mr. Schmidt came to Washington to underline is that they would far rather see, from West Europe and West Germany in particular, the American government, the federal banks, loosen up federal spending, loans, all that type of thing, interest rates, to encourage the economy, to stimulate the economy, to get going on building and sales and business and industry once again, and let prices find their own ceiling, thereby abandoning the fight against inflation in favor of trying to fight recession, if you follow me. Stimulate business, stimulate the economy by putting more money in circulation, fighting the unemployment and that type of thing, and then don't worry about inflation. Well, President Ford has committed himself and his administration to attacking inflation and bringing it under control. Now, it goes beyond just a little bit of concern by one leader of government with what is happening in the economic picture inside another government. I have said for many, many years that any shift in the economic climate in Germany could lead to far more serious consequences than it ever would inside the United States. They are a different people. They do think differently, and they react differently in times of crisis. If we are really headed now, as many people seem to think we are, for a deep depression globally around the world, it's obvious that we are already in global recession. Worldwide recession is clearly underway. That's positive. That's a fact. But so far, many people think close cooperation in the developed industrial countries can prevent the deepest part of a depression, meaning jobless up to 20% or something like this, where we go back to government programs like WPA, soup lines, bread lines, massive tens of millions of people out of jobs, reduced to an absolute poverty level of existence to where the entirety of the world, in a sense, is impoverished simply because of these seemingly uncontrollable forces of human greed, jealousy, hatred, vanity, and lust. So Mr. Schmidt is here, confronted with his own downturn in the German economy and the highest unemployment rate they've had in years, to try to tell Mr. Ford we ought to get busy in the United States to stimulate the economy because he fears that any deeper and prolonged recession in the United States, lasting on past early spring, as some people thought it would be over by then, or midsummer of 1975, might push other European countries into deeper economic recessions and trigger what he felt might be a kind of an epidemic of begging among neighbors policies. You see, maybe the Chancellor of West Germany knows something we don't. Maybe he has already seen the handwriting on the wall inside both NATO and the EEC that when individual nations are faced with individual crises, they tend to go it alone and work out their own individual solutions. They don't always act within the framework of a European economic community, nor will the EEC always act within the framework of commitments and promises to the United States. Sometimes they simply decide in favor of themselves and they go it alone. Well, what would a shift in the economic climate in West Germany do? What would an end to the post-war boom do? What would massive unemployment and a deep recession do? I believe it would lead toward an ultra-rightist government. I believe it would lead directly toward a new extremist form of a virtual military dictatorship. And I believe that the government over there would simply change hands, and that political parties far to the right of the present political spectrum would come into power. Furthermore, I believe Bible prophecy says that is exactly what will occur. Not that it has to occur. The Bible also says, as for prophecies, they shall fail. That prayer can change things, that massive national repentance can change things, that things don't have to work out the way God threatens or the way God warns they will work out. They can be changed by a reaction in the people God is trying to reach with His message. But for many, many years on this program, we have talked about the ultimate emergence of a 10-nation combine inside Europe, which will be literally a kind of an end-time resurrection of the same old system that had ruled and dominated through that European area from the time clear back before Jesus Christ. Like a modern-day, end-time, space-age, jet-age, machine-age Roman Empire of a gigantic conglomerate of nations which would literally be the biggest power the world has ever seen. It's supposed to be a gigantic trading power. It is called in the Bible, figuratively, Babylon the Great. There are prophecies all through the book of Revelation, prophecies in Ezekiel and elsewhere that talk about this great emerging trading combine. Back in Ezekiel, the 27th chapter, for example, there's a great deal said about a great trading union of nations and where their merchandise and their marketing is being done. And it talks in the 18th chapter of the book of Revelation about Babylon the Great and its eventual fall. In Ezekiel 27, it is likened to ancient Tyre. But here was a prophecy in the 26th chapter of how Tyre was going to come to a complete total destruction, and it was. It was scraped like the top of a rock. The ancient city was totally destroyed. Today there is a town over there nearby that is not exactly on the same site, fairly close to it, having utilized some of the pillars and the columns that were built there by the Greeks later on, after ancient Tyre, the Tyrrhenians of that seacoast, after that city had been destroyed by the armies of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. Tyre was destroyed. Yet here in this prophecy, in the 27th chapter of Ezekiel, is an end-time prophecy that mentions some of the people who are clearly identified on modern maps, and sometimes even obviously by the names that are used. For instance, Syria is mentioned here, Judah, and the land of Israel is mentioned, Damascus is mentioned, all of those places are still there. But who is modern-day Tyre? And who is Tarshish? And who is Javan, Tubal, and Meshach? What is all this trading back and forth? Here in the 27th chapter of Ezekiel is a prophecy about Tyre. It says, "Son of man, take up a lamentation for Tyrus, and say unto Tyrus," or Tyre, "O thou that art situate at the entry of the sea." Tyre was an ancient seaport. This involves, then, a gigantic sea-faring nation, or conglomerate, because it is used interchangeably. Now, those that are biblical scholars will know instantly when I say Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14 what I mean, because those two chapters both use the prince or the king of Babylon or Tyre interchangeably as a type of Satan the devil. In the one place, he is called the Prince of Tyre, the other place called the King of Babylon. In each scene, the setting changes, and you see that antitypically it is talking about that great fallen archangel that was called Lucifer, and you can read those chapters in your home if you would like. The point that I am making is that Bible prophecy seems to use almost interchangeably two former great trading cities that were at the very pinnacle of power during the time centuries before Jesus Christ. Tyre had been the metropolis of the ancient eastern Mediterranean area for about 1,000 years. Here is a picture of a great trading combine, a great commercial city, a great seaport, a seafaring city, totally collapsing, and how all the merchants are crying and wailing as a result of it. And over in the 18th chapter of the book of Revelation, you see exactly the same thing. Now, the 27th chapter of Ezekiel leads right on into the 28th that I mentioned, and this type of this Prince of Tyre, who says, as he sits in the midst of the seas, and it gets on into a type, as it says, of Satan the devil. But it says in verse 4 of that chapter, "With your wisdom and with your understanding you have gotten you riches, and have gotten gold and silver into your treasures, by your great wisdom and your traffic Have you increased your riches and your heart is lifted up because of your riches? I'll get into Revelation, the 18th chapter, in just a few more minutes, but let's look at this 27th chapter of Ezekiel first. So he says it is situate at the entry of the sea. And he says in verse 4, thy borders are in the midst of the sea. Now the ancient city was, because finally it was built on a causeway, New Tyre was, and was virtually an island city. There were gates, it could be controlled, and ships could sail inside the city and simply be locked up in there. It had canals. Now Tyre was the major city of what was called the Phoenician, P-H-O-E, I believe it is, N-E-C-I-A-N, the way it used to be spelled in Old English, the Phoenician seacoast. The Phoenician people were seafarers. You know, in the Spanish language, in the Latin language, in the so-called Romance tongues, take the Italian language, for example, there would be a different way of pronouncing Venetia or Phoenicia or Phoenicia. Can you think of a city that might be peopled by the very end-time modern descendants of some of those who occupied the Tyrrhenian, that's an interesting word, isn't it, and the Phoenician seacoast in the ancient city of Tyre? You ever heard of a city that has ships sailing right on into it, boats of all types and size and description sailing right on into the midst of it, that is a seafaring city? Those are just interesting things that don't prove anything one way or the other, and frankly, I don't think the city of Venezia, which is the way they pronounce it over there in Italy, or Venice, as we say in English, is necessarily the city which is implied by Ezekiel 27, because I believe it is a typical prophecy involving a whole trading combine, and I think that's proved in Revelation, the 18th chapter. But it's interesting, at least, that some of those names have even been changed or taken over there that are very similar. And so you find in Tyre the word Tyrrhenian. And where is Tyrol? Where do some of those names come from? Where are the Tyrolean Alps? Well, some of those peoples migrated clear off into northern Italy and on up into the mountains that separate Italy from France and from Switzerland. And you'll find some of those names there, stamped on mountains, stamped on a sea. Where's the Tyrrhenian Sea? You ever found out where that is? And the Adriatic, that area? You know where Venice is, of course. Well, as you look at modern maps, it's kind of interesting to find out what were some of the ancient names of peoples mentioned even in Bible prophecy, and where did they go? From Genoa on the west to Venice on the east, you know, the entire Italian boot projects right down into the Mediterranean Sea. And here is a prophecy about a figurative or an end-time Tyre, a great trading combine whose borders are in the midst of the seas. And it says, thy builders have perfected your beauty. Then it talks about all the things that are traded. And, of course, it uses the things that were habitually traded by sea, by ship, and by camel caravan centuries and centuries ago. Raw materials, fine woods, linens, ivory. And ivory, by the way, came from Africa and India and Southeast Asia. It talks about mariners and merchants and pilots of ships. It says in verse 10, they of Persia and of Lud and of Put were in your army. Now those peoples are found today. The word Put, for example, is sometimes translated Ethiopia. It doesn't really mean that as much as it means, I believe, the people of India, Bangladesh, and Pakistan. And those peoples of Persia today and of the subcontinent of India. And it says the men of Arvad, I don't have the faintest idea where they are. Tarshish, that's an interesting word in verse 12. Who were the Tartars of ancient ages? Tarshish. Who in the world was he? These people were basically men, you know, and they became the progenitors of whole nations and groups of nations of people, and they're still identified in the pages of Bible prophecy today. And you can look back at some of the ancient names, and you can trace right on down into modern times, and you can see that through native tongues, as you might say, or some tribal languages, that even though there may be a slight change in pronunciation, there is an easily discernible connection between some of these ancient names of people and modern-day peoples on modern-day maps. When you look clear back into the tables of nations in Genesis, the 10th chapter, you see the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and you see who their sons were. Now, all Bible scholars and historians recognize that primarily the Japhetic races are the Orientals, the people who settled in the eastern Asian areas of the world. They recognize that the Hamitic tended to become the black races and settled in Africa, and from there, other parts of the world as well. And that the Semitic peoples, And you know what that means, Shem, although a lot of people think Semitic means Jewish. That is ridiculous to the extreme, because Semitic was a son of Noah way back before, during, and after, of course, the flood. And his children, all of the children of Shem, scattered out to become virtually, literally, even the Arabs of today. And here you have the Jew-Arab controversy, and yet they eventually, way back down the line far enough, came from the same progenitors. They all came through Abraham, and in that sense are brothers, clear on back prior to the time of Moses. It's too bad that people can't really look upon themselves as brothers and get along as brothers instead of hating one another and fighting and going to war. If they understood their common origins, maybe they would feel a little differently about it. But who is this Japheth you keep seeing? Tarshish, Javan, Tubal, and Meshech. Who are those people? The sons of Japheth, listed in chapter 10 and verse 2 of the book of Genesis, are Gomer and Magog and Madai or Madai, from which we take the modern word Medes or Media. Javan, I have asked time and again, where do you find the island of Java? J-A-V-A. And Japan. And why do you find those names, even in the way we pronounce it in the English language today, stamped indelibly in Southeastern Asia and Japan? And they come from the Japhetic, J-A-P-H-E-T-H, Japhetic races. Here also, though, was Javan and Tubal, and you find a major city. It's been changed. They changed all the names of the cities, or a lot of them at least, after the Soviet Revolution and even following World War II. I should say the Bolshevik Revolution, but at least it led to the Soviet Union of today. And they changed the name Tobolsk and that area, which I think is found as a modern-day pronunciation of ancient Tubal. And Meshech was found as Moskva or Moscow, a derivation of that name. Tyrus, I'm not sure where you will find some of the modern names that are Tyrus. That's T-I, not T-Y, although it may certainly imply some of the same people. The sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, Riphath, Togarma, the sons of Javan were Elisha. And it's interesting that some of those Oriental peoples, even across the land bridge of the Bering Sea and on into the northern part of the North American continent, called the area where they lived Elishka, or some Indian word or Eskimo word that sounded like that, and so we name it Alaska. And yet here is one of the sons of Javan, whose name was Elisha, and Tarshish. Oh, well then, Tarshish, that we read of back there in the 27th of Ezekiel, is one of the sons of Javan, who is one of the sons of Japheth. So who then would be this fantastic seafaring collection of people, who are merchants, who trade in all kinds of basic raw materials, iron, tin, lead, it's all listed here. And Javan, Tubal, and Meshech, they were your merchants. They traded the persons of men, slavery, it says, and vessels of brass in your market. They of the house of Togarma traded in your fairs. It says Syria was thy merchant. Judah and the land of Israel were merchants. Damascus, Dan, Javan, Dedan, Arabia, and the princes of Kedar, the Middle East. All of them are listed in this gigantic trading combine. And notice verse 25 of that chapter says, the ships of Tarshish did sing of you in your market. Tarshish, a son of Javan, who was a son of Japheth. Now, who would be a great Oriental seafaring power that would rise up to massive wealth and economic stability and military strength as a part of a great trading combine that virtually had a hold on the entirety of all of the world's trade in the latter times just prior to an intervention of God on the face of this earth, if it is not the tremendously powerful nation of Japan? That's all speculation, many people could say, and I would agree with them. That's true, because you see, when you fully know the one surest prophecy in all the Bible is the return of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, and when you know the only salvation, physically even, the only way of escape and protection for humankind is the intervention of God on this earth to set up a kingdom on this earth and to rule it with a rod of iron, when you know the major Bible prophecies that say there is going to come a 10-nation combine that is called, figuratively, a beast that will rear up somewhere in Europe, that there will be a gigantic trading combine here, and that one great trader who will trade in this figurative Babylon or this figurative Tyre will be called Tarshish, from an eastern area that will be trading in its fairs and its markets. Yes, you tend to speculate. You're tempted to speculate a little bit because you want to know exactly what that means and how it's going to come about. Many times you aren't really able to tell exactly how. I could speculate, for example, that maybe there will come a civil war in Yugoslavia. I could say that the Serbs and the Croats may go at it again at some time in the future, and maybe the northern part will draw out and become a part of a 10-nation union in Europe. But that would be speculation. I don't know that. Is that possible in this topsy-turvy world? Sure, it's possible. Can I call out in a limb and say, it's got to happen, it's going to happen? No, I can't. So I can just say, keep your eye on Yugoslavia and watch what Tito is doing. That's all I can say. Do I know exactly how God counts those 10? No, I don't. Because sometimes ethnic groups may be mentioned in the Bible, and that may have been what God meant, rather than a political group, if you follow me. Political groups can consist of many ethnic groups. One political entity, such as a nation with its national political borders, can embody several different peoples. Yugoslavia is a case in point, the Serbs and the Croats, to the north and the south. They're different people, and they basically hate each other. At least traditionally they did, with different forms and cultures and styles and different dialects and language and even differing religions. So sometimes you speculate because of this great beast you see back in verse 12 of Revelation 17. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, he says, which have received no kingdom as yet, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. And these have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. The power and strength of a nation is its economy, its industry, its military, its industrial base, its raw materials. It is the foreign policy. It's the commitment of mutual defense programs. They shall give their power and strength unto the beast, this great trading combine, and these shall make war with the Lamb, it says, indicating the time element, that it's at the time of the end. Here in the 18th chapter of the book of Revelation, it says Babylon is fallen. It talks about a great trading combine and says she has lived deliciously. It says the shipfarers, the pilots, and all of those who have lived with her shall stand afar off, seeing the smoke of her burning, saying, alas, for that great city Babylon, that mighty city, in 1 hour is your judgment come. And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buys their merchandise anymore. And the 18th chapter is a tremendous parallel with the 27th chapter of Ezekiel, of this great trading combine that shall finally emerge as an ultra-rightist, extremist form of government, a super government, a block of countries all united into one third power block between the Soviet Union and the United States before it's all over. You're going to see it happen. Europe is going to be welded together into a powerful military dictatorship someday. It won't happen suddenly. It'll take time. But Bible prophecy says it's going to occur. If you want to know where you are mentioned in Bible prophecy, you want to write for this booklet entitled The United States and the British Commonwealth in Prophecy. It's called The United States and the British Commonwealth in Prophecy. Just mention the U.S. in Prophecy. We'll know what you mean. Get the up-to-the-moment, hard-hitting prophecy paper called The Plain Truth. It's The Plain Truth. It dares to make the truth plain, and there isn't any subject you won't see covered in the pages of The Plain Truth. It's absolutely free of charge, and all you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.